This is a Dreamcast disc and is for use only on a Dreamcast unit. Playing this disc on a hi-fi or other audio equipment can cause serious damage to its speakers.
Dreamcast, up to 6 billion players.
Welcome back to the stage of history.
Why don't we play together?
Hey, it's time to make some crazy money. Are you ready? Here we go!
Please stop this disc now.
Hello and welcome, Dreamers. My name is Andrew Dickinson and you've joined us for another episode of Dreamcast Years. I mean, the DreamPod. This episode may have the potential to get me a little confused, and that's because we're doing a crossover. This is the first of four episodes we'll be doing over the coming months, each one focused on a different year of the Dreamcast's original lifespan. We'll be starting in 1999, however, as there's just not enough to discuss in 1998 to sustain a whole episode, but we'll probably briefly mention it this time around. As this is a crossover between the Dreamcast Junkyard and Dreamcast Years, I'll be pulling bits from each podcast and mashing them together to create a freakish hybrid. That means you can expect some weird intros, a random question to start us off, some information about the year at hand, and even a quiz. And unlike Dreamcast Years, though, where we discuss gaming overall, we'll be sticking strictly to the Dreamcast here, exploring its launches, hits, misses, and various games released during this time. Before we go any further, though, I should really introduce you to the fantastic foursome joining me today. And first up, from the Dreamcast and Saturn Junkyard, it's the Titan himself, Shenmue lover and Saturn fanatic, all the way from the US of A, it's Brian Vines. How are you?
The mute button is, like, not responsive for me here. doing good. Thanks for having me on, Andrew.
All right, continuing on, next up, it's one of my co-hosts from DCY and the former forklift license owner who up until recently had the Twitter handle Dreamcast Barber. Yes, that's a reference to the excellent shave ad of the very year that we're discussing today, but boy, oh boy, that's B-U-O-Y. He might be in for some ribbing today now he's changed it. Please welcome Rich Elsie. Hi, Rich. How's it going?
Good, thanks. And you really shouldn't tease or rib a qualified forklift driver because, you know, just qualifications, you know, just you need to just steer clear of me. You never know when I'm going to come at you with a forklift. And
true. Did it just magically appear if you're angry at somebody?
Exactly.
Just
exactly.
Ready to go.
Exactly.
Awesome. Okay, next. I'm pretty sure I made a promise never to mention him last when introducing him on a podcast, so here he is in third place. He loves racing so much that he has an entire Twitch account dedicated to it. He may claim to be bang average, but on DreamPod, he's anything but. Please welcome old Jazz Hands himself. It's James Harvey.
Hey, thank you, Andrew. I am very good, thanks. I am not able to race on a real circuit at the moment, so as per usual, spending all my hours on Spirit of Speed on the Dreamcast.
Of course. I mean, you've had 10 pages to write about that thing, you know?
And I enjoyed every single letter, and I hope everyone else will when they read it back as well.
I'm sure they will. It's I've had a read of it. It's very good. Very, very good. Last but by no means least, it's the man who completes the trifecta that is Dreamcast Years. His vocal talents are legendary, and his dislike of Shenmue will make him one new friend and potentially a new enemy on this very podcast. His taste in games is otherwise top-notch, though. It's Mr. Steve Leyland. How's it going?
Hello. I'm very well. How are you?
I'm good, thank you. You're going to have... So I know Brian is a Shenmue fan.
Yeah, must
and
we,
I know
must
that James
we,
is very
must
not
we do
a
this,
Shenmue fan.
Andrew, must we stir up the Shenmue?
Like, down with Shenmue.
You've got some of these on your side, though, to be honest. Sure. So that's why I brought it up.
Okay.
Well, but here's the thing. I mean, I also wouldn't consider myself on any side as much as I personally enjoy the game. I couldn't really hold anybody to any sort of expectation that they should view it through the lens, favorable lens. It just, I don't know, it's such a divisive game, and I'm more interested in how it pokes and prods at the seams of the medium rather than how it performs as a, you know, a good game, quote unquote.
I mean, I'm going to hold my hands up. Yeah, I've been playing Shenmue 3 finally after, what, about 2-3 years of waiting to play it, and I'm actually starting to see where it's a bit shit.
Yeah.
Wow.
But I think it's because I'm seeing myself playing like a game from like 2017, 2018. I'm like, this should be... I don't know. They're trying to be too faithful to the formula, and it feels...
Those mechanics were bad then, though, is the thing.
Yeah.
Hang on. Is this some sort of Shenmue podcast you've managed to get me on, Andrew, by telling me it's something else? Or are we actually going to discuss some good things on here or what?
Yeah, no, apologies. We are discussing Shenmue's 1-3-3. completely tricked. No, I'm joking. Don't worry. We are talking about the Dreamcast in 1999. We'll move away from Shenmue. Shenmue wasn't released in this year in the West, so we can ignore it for the time being. Maybe we'll come back to it. Well, we will come back to it in a future episode, which James will no doubt avoid.
So we will like keep our powder dry until then, I suppose.
It's probably the safe choice.
All right, so with the introductions out of the way, let's get started in the DreamPod style. I've got a question for all of you. You ready?
Mm-hmm. Oh, yes.
Ready?
Yep. Okay. And the question is, Britney or Christina? For all of you not up on your late 90s pop music, I am, of course, referring to the bitter rivalry between fans of Britney Spears and Christina Aguilera in this year, and you must pick a side. Rich?
See, I was going to go with Mandy Moore, so that's a bit of a shame.
Oh, yeah. Interesting choice.
Jessica
there.
Simpson was a bit shit, but I was a Mandy guy. I must admit.
Okay.
Yeah.
I'll accept that.
But
Brian,
I would say Britney between the two.
Oh, okay. Fair enough. Brian, what about yourself?
That's hard. I think at the time it was probably Christina, just because I felt she had an amazing voice and whatnot. But I don't know, history, like just kind of seeing how much shit that are we allowed to say shit here?
Yeah, go for it.
All right. As much shit as especially Britney Spears, but a lot of pop idols of that era had gone through. I don't know. I mean, I just have a lot of respect for her as well. So unfortunately, I'm going to have to cop out. Maybe today I'd say Britney. So okay. There you go.
Okay. Another day you might say Christina. It changes by the day.
As does my favorite Dreamcast game. So, yeah.
Same. Same, absolutely. Steve, come on, you got to pick a side.
I have to pick a side.
You have to pick a side.
Okay. I don't want anyone to make the mistake of thinking that I had some kind of position at the time, because I absolutely did not. And it's not that I think I'm too cool to have a side. I just didn't know anything about music at the time. I would pick Britney, I guess. That's based on absolutely nothing, though. Just want to make that clear.
Fair enough. That's fine. You've picked a side. You know, it doesn't mean anything. But there you go. James, what about you?
As a hormonal teenage boy at the time, I absolutely had a position on this. And it's nothing to do with music talent whatsoever. I'm afraid anyone that can look good in a red cat suit and wear a schoolgirl outfit was very much high in my agenda. I was very much a Britney boy. And I believe I did own her first album, but didn't listen to it much.
Okay. It
was just for the pictures. And yeah. I remember many, many posters in my bedroom wall of Britney in that that fond era.
If we're going on that context, can I choose both? Is that allowed?
I mean, yeah, just to remind you that the dirty era of Christina Aguilera didn't come until a few years later.
Yeah.
That's what we're looking at. But yeah, go on. I'll let you have. I mean, I did say pick a side, and you have picked Britney, but in that particular thing, that's fine. Yeah, that's fine. I mean, I'd find it difficult to choose, and I don't find them attractive, you know, for obvious reasons. But Britney, I mean, I've been a Britney fan since the beginning. I taped her Baby One More Time video from MTV and watched it on repeat until my mum bought me the single, so I'd kind of stop using the television. So, yeah.
So did I, Andrew, actually, but probably for different reasons.
At least we can bond over it, even if it was for different reasons. We both did the same thing. It's fine. It's fine. There we go. A nice question to start us off. Break the ice. And okay, let's move on to the more Dreamcast year side of this whole affair, which is where you get to listen to me reel off what was going on in the world in 1999. Please do interject if you feel like it. But do remember, this is 22 years ago. 22 years. My goodness.
Ouch.
All right. Here we go. I'm gonna get started. One for you, James. Vauxhall launched a new version of the Vector in 1999. No idea if you like Vauxhall. Just know you like cars.
If you expected me to get excited about Vauxhall, then you've read the room incorrectly, Andrew. Carry on.
Ross Kemp, who played Grant Mitchell on the BBC soap EastEnders, left the show this year after 10 years after signing a new contract with rival ITV. Brian has no idea what I'm talking about, I'm sure. he's shaking his head. He does not. former Manchester United manager Alex Ferguson and ITV newsreader Trevor McDonald received knighthoods in this year. In the art world, Tracy Emin unveiled her controversial piece of modern art, in inverted commas, My Bed, at the Tate Gallery, which later sold at auction in 2014 for an astonishing £2,556,500. Absolutely. And I will remind you, this was just an unmade bed.
I've seen that in person. I can confirm. Are you impressed? It is just an unmade bed.
Yeah, that is modern art for you. Modern art. The euro was launched in this year, the European currency adopted by 11 nations at the time and now the official currency of 19 member states.
How did that all work out, that whole situation with the with Europe?
With Europe? With the EU? Oh, it worked out fantastically.
Everyone was happy. Oh,
really? It's great.
Yeah. Oh, good. Cool.
Yeah, they're doing so well. We're
glad those guys made it.
moving on. Famous births this year include American rapper, singer and songwriter Lil Nas X, whose birthday is April 9th. And only a month prior, acclaimed film director Stanley Kubrick died at the age of 70 in the year 1999.
What a legend.
R.I.P. Legend indeed. Some amazing films. I've not seen Eyes Wide Shut yet, actually. I was always a bit iffy about that film. Any good for a final film of a director?
I thought it was good. Ironically, the one film of his I never used to like was Clockwork Orange, which is one of the ones that everybody goes on about. Mm-hmm. But I think Full Metal Jacket would have to be my number one Stanley film, I think.
Sorry, we're not a movie review podcast. I'll continue. In television, shows like Holby City, Bob the Builder, The League of Gentlemen, Angry Kid and Queer as Folk debuted in the UK, while big American shows like The Sopranos, The West Wing, Family Guy, Futurama, Angel and Sonic Underground aired for the very first time.
One of these is not like the others.
I remember having a Papa Lazaro shirt, if you want to get onto The League of Gentlemen. Subject is a shirt I would never wear nowadays.
No.
Yeah. I can still picture it. I'm like, I don't know what I was thinking at the time, but yeah, I would never wear it now. Less said the better.
When you first said that, I wondered if there was a character called Papa Lazaro in Sonic Underground for a second.
I wish there was. I mean, knowing Sega, there probably will be next week. So we're going to have one more friend. You know.
The same guy.
You're my wife now, Dave. I can't do impressions. Pardon me. Movies released this year included The Matrix, Star Wars Episode 1, The Blair Witch Project, and The World Is Not Enough. So some big movies there. And music is always a divisive subject when we talk about music. And usually I will go for the top 10 singles of the year in the UK, but I thought I'd go for albums this time just to see what that's like. And so I'm just going to read them out. So in the 10th biggest selling album of 1999 in the UK was On How Life Is by Macy Gray. Number 9 was Westlife by Westlife.
Good job, boys. Westlife by Westlife.
Yeah, self-titled albums, always a cop-out, isn't it? Number 8, Talk on Corners by The Corrs. 7, Steptacular. I was about to say Spectacular, but it is Steptacular by Steps, who are still going today, oddly enough. Number all 6.
All of the members or just some of them?
All of them. They got back together.
Just even floor, Ian
Watkins, not that Ian Watkins. Sorry, every time. I have to mention it every time.
You have to, every time.
Number 6, Robbie Williams' album, I've Been Expecting You. Number 5, Stereophonics, Performance and Cocktails. Number 4, ABBA, Gold, Greatest Hits, which is interesting. Number 3, Travis, The Man Who. Number 2, Boyzone, By Request. Boyzone, my goodness. It was the time of the boy band, of course. And number 1, And probably the only one that Brian will even recognize is Shania Twain, Come On Over, which was a big album for that year. So there you go.
Yeah, it was the only CD in my aunt's CD deck in her car for like at least 6 months or a year. So, yeah.
Yeah. That got played like over and over. Like all the songs from that were on the radio like constantly. Mm-hmm. But there you go. All right. So with that background of what life was like for us all in 1999, let's talk Dreamcast, shall we? Finally. So the just to touch on 1998 quickly, we had the Japanese launch, of course, on the 27th of November in 1998, so just before 1999. Does anybody have any memories of that, of when it launched over in Japan?
Only really just seeing the pictures of the launch in gaming magazines, really. That was all I really remember at the time. Mm-hmm. Back in the good old days when literally it was just pictures on a page. You didn't have, you know, YouTube videos of live launches. That was probably really it. Other than playing a Japanese Dreamcast in a store in my local town. That was the first time I played one, playing Sonic Adventure on import.
Oh, really?
Yeah, but otherwise, yeah, that's about it.
It was, I've told this story before on the Junkyard pod, but the Dreamcast was the first sort of console that I properly lusted over when it was released in Japan, in the sense of I was desperate to get my hands on one. And similar, really, to Rich, it was kind of reading magazines, and I vividly remember it now, the CVG magazine article they did in 98 where they kind of sent Ed Lomas over to Japan to some tiny show where they kind of had a few Dreamcasts signed up when he was playing Virtua Fighter and Godzilla, and I was just like so desperate to import one, but poor teenage me, 14, 15 at the time, was in no way able to afford that, so I had to wait until UK release. But yeah, I was it was the first console I was properly following up to launch, you know, desperately waiting for it to make its way over.
Yeah, it's an interesting launch as well, because there were only four titles on offer when the Dreamcast launched in Japan, which was July, Godzilla Generations, Virtua Fighter 3 TB, and
Pen Pen.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
So, because they didn't get Sonic Adventure until December over there. Yeah. So, but yeah, quite a small launch lineup. Like, I don't think they'd get away. I mean, they didn't get away with it over here because they had like 18, 19 games. But four games, that's not many at all, really.
I mean, it seemed like that was pretty standard, though, for Japanese console launches at the time. Maybe for a while since, yeah.
Yeah, 64 had, what, three games or two? Was it? It was Mario. There was the
Mario and Pilot Wings.
And there was some Shogi game as well, yeah. I think, that came out as a three. But yeah, it was pretty normal to have less than half a dozen games for most console launches. In fact, it was quite similar over here, if you remember. And it was the Dreamcast that kind of bucked that trend when the Dreamcast got launched, because it was like, Here's 12 games to pick from. Possibly more than that, but
Yeah, I think we had 19 in North America, and I think there was like 20 or something in Europe.
I mean, I'm looking now at the book.
And then PS2 comes along. That's like 29.
Think
or
about it this
crazy
way, though, Andrew. You know, we're back to consoles launching now with zero exclusive games on them. So look at modern consoles.
That's crazy, isn't
Xbox
it?
Launch with nothing that you have to have that console to play on.
Yeah.
So, you know,
6 months later, it's still the same. Amazing.
Exactly.
There were four other games that came out after the launch in Japan in 1998, which was Incoming, Seventh Cross Evolution, Sonic Adventure, of course, and Tetris 4D. So eight games in the space of 2 months. I mean, personally, I would have been really peed off, especially at launch. Like, Godzilla Generations is a launch title. I cannot stand that game. That is an awful, awful game. And yet people they didn't have much choice. If they wanted to play new console games, that was one of them.
It's not a great lineup in general, is it? I mean, Virtua Fighter was a pretty lazy port. I'm not going to get into Sonic Adventure because I'm going to make more enemies if I start talking about how that was just a bit of a cluster F in 3D.
Right, I'm on your side.
And one more friend as well, like Shenmue.
I mean, there's not really much in the way of of, it certainly didn't have that one killer app, did it? That a lot of the most consoles at the time, they had few games, but they had one that was like, okay, this is why I bought this thing, like a Mario 64 or a Ridge Racer or you know, something like that. I don't think Dreamcast had that, which was a shame, really.
Yeah, I mean, like, obviously we had things like Sonic Adventure and we had Virtua Fighter and stuff like that, but there was a lot of games around that launch time that never ever came out here. I mean, we didn't get Seventh Cross, of course, but I know America did. Is that one that you played, Brian, at all? Have you played Seventh Cross Evolution?
I never played it. I've just seen some write-ups of it. I think Tom really liked that game, actually.
I'm kind of interested.
Maybe like is the wrong word.
Maybe. 1998. I think the Japanese launch suffered from not enough consoles to cover how many they wanted to sell, so there was a lot of shortages there. And so by the time they launched over here, over in America and in Europe, they'd done their best to try and rectify that. And of course, it sold like the clappers in America, especially. It sold crazy numbers on launch. Like it broke records, which is a bit of a surprise considering how the Dreamcast ended. The fact that it started so well is pretty amazing, I think.
You know, from a console launch perspective, a lot of consoles start off well because ultimately there's only so many they can produce, and ultimately early adopters are going to buy regardless. So I think it's almost a bit of a false narrative, because I think there's an argument to say almost every console when it's launched, apart from the Saturn, generates record numbers because of the nature of the beast that, you know, the like I said, the people that are going to buy early days are going to buy it regardless of how much it costs and what games are available on the machine. So I think, and I think it was at that time, wasn't it, where kind of, you know, people had been, they were ready for that next step, even though there was that temptation of waiting for a PS2, which is, as we all know, what ultimately killed it all off. But I think there was still going to be, I guess the argument is the people who bought a Dreamcast in the first kind of month were always going to buy a PS2 as well anyway. When that came out, it wasn't a case of I'm going to buy a Dreamcast, I'm not going to buy two consoles. Whereas the reason it kind of started to stall a bit then, I guess, moving forward, is now you're into the territory of people that are picking one or the other, and now you're starting to see all the people that have backed the PlayStation horse waited out until PS2 is released, is I guess how it ultimately played out.
What kind of grabbed me the most was the fact that in America, it broke the record that the PlayStation had currently held for most pre-ordered console. I think the PlayStation had 100,000 pre-orders for it before it released, and the Dreamcast had 300,000. So it kind of tripled, you know, what the PlayStation had. And on top of that, it did that while the advertising was incredibly, what's the word, odd. I mean, the posters they had over in America they didn't even mention Dreamcast. There was nothing about the games. It was like pictures of eyes and stuff. That was about all you had, right?
Yep, and swirly hurricanes and just
weirdness.
I mean, I also wonder, going back to the pre-order point, I wonder how much of that was just a shift in the infrastructure in the gaming landscape, because in 1995, when the PlayStation launched, I mean, I'm not sure a lot of places or a lot of retailers had started doing pre-orders yet, at least as we currently conceive of them. And so that's could just be a product of that becoming a little more popular by 99.
Stop ruining Andrew's narrative, will you? Come on now, Brian.
Sorry. I'm always, yeah. Just
I definitely agree. I think there's definitely, you know, I know the internet wasn't really a big thing then, but you still did have the kind of the dawn of some of the early internet sort of, regular kind of gaming news and stuff, but in general I think awareness was just higher of video games in general kind of at that point. And as you said, I mean, it's probably a coincidence, but you know, I was at an age where I first started pre-ordering games, you know, up to the Dreamcast coming out. Like, I think Gran Turismo was the first game I ever pre-ordered on PlayStation a couple of years previous. But well, maybe that was just an age thing for me, but I think there was definitely more awareness of what was coming out, and it was less about, you know, going into town and going into your video game store and like looking at shelves and thinking, oh my God, what's this game? It's kind of, you kind of know what's coming out and what to expect.
Mm-hmm. I think in terms of the US launch as well, you have to be fair as well and look at the fact they used Limp Bizkit for some of the early advertising for the promoting the online features and SegaNet. I mean, that must have shifted a few units. I would have bought one just simply off the strength of Fred Durst. I mean,
yeah, that must have shifted at least two units off the back of that.
The price.
I would have bought both.
The price as well was definitely a factor in getting selling out so soon. I mean, it's not quite impulse purchase range, but I think it certainly would have been. Again, going back to my earlier argument, people who were going to buy a PS2 anyway would have been like, "Oh well, it's only $200 for the next couple of years, so I may as well jump in at this point." And I think the Dreamcast had enough going for it from a tech perspective that I think we can all agree that the Dreamcast was the first kind of console that caught up with the arcade. Right? It was when we first started. I know it wasn't actually arcade perfect, but it was the first console where, to the untrained eye, you couldn't really tell the difference between something that was running in an arcade and something that was running on your TV at home. So I think for the price point that they introduced that at, it would have been a no-brainer. I mean, I just think, if it was now and I'm in a situation where I can afford to buy things on impulse like that, it's at that price point that just feels like, yeah, why not pick that up? Whereas, again, buying a Series X or a PlayStation 5 at what's basically £400-£500 or dollars is, there's a bit more of a choice that has to be made there, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And plus the value of, and making it easier to get everybody else in your household to buy into the idea that, oh, we're really just getting a DVD player. And it happens to have, I can happen to play all these PlayStation games on it, including all the ones that Sony had been pushing for the last generation, that it was fully backwards compatible. So, they really did make that a pretty seamless value proposition, which I kind of hate that phrase, but whatever. It was a pretty damn good one, if that's what it was.
Yeah. I mean, and Dreamcast was the same. It didn't have DVD, of course, but it had online functionality, and that was a huge selling point. Even if you couldn't play games online to start with, you could surf the internet, which was a big deal back then. And
yeah, that's true.
I mean, I know in the US you had to spend money, you had to still have to pay a monthly subscription, but in the UK and Europe you didn't. You just kind of logged on and you just paid your phone bill, and you didn't have to pay any extra for an ISP service for it, which was a huge deal, because up until that point, if you wanted the internet, you would have to pay like AOL or FreeServe or whoever was your ISP of choice monthly fee to go online. So,
and this was at a time where PCs were not, it wasn't a given that everyone had a PC in their house, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, a lot of people did by sort of 99, 2000, but it was still not something that you expected people to have. I mean, I know my best mate had, the Dreamcast was their primary internet browsing emailing thing in their house. I still have his keyboard here. It's his actual keyboard that I stole off him back in the day, and I still use it online nowadays. But it was their family surfing the net device, which is probably how he managed to get it purchased for him in the first place. But like everything else, I mean, it's all, the Dreamcast has always been touted as being sort of a victim of its own kind of innovation, in that it was a bit ahead of its time in many ways. And I think it was the same for internet, really. I mean, as good as it was, and as good as it was that it offered all that stuff out of the box, the fact is it just wasn't on people's minds back then, or it was, but only on a certain few. I don't think there was many people thinking, I need to get that because I can go online. Because as I said, most people still, going online was an internet cafe thing, or maybe something you did on a Saturday if your parents let you use the modem then,
I'm trying to think now. Steve, can you help me remember? Was there a web browser on the PS2? Because they brought a broadband adapter. Was that just for online play? I can't remember.
That was just for online play. There was no web browser on the PS2. And I think it took a little while for that mode, that adapter to come out as well.
Yeah, it was a good couple of years, because I think it came out around the same time as Resident Evil Outbreak, I think, for us. Mm-hmm.
I think it was later than that, yeah, because Outbreak didn't have online in Europe.
Outbreak 2 did, I remember, actually.
That's what I bought my broadband adapter for on a PS2. It was for '06, which I, funny enough, we dug out the other day.
Amazing. That's cool. But yeah, it's crazy that the Dreamcast had that, and Sony obviously didn't think it was important enough to put that into their console that came out after it. Which is strange. They banked everything on DVD, I guess. So, mm-hmm.
I mean, Nintendo still don't, do they? So, you know. Yeah. Maybe they'll prioritize online gaming at some point in the next generation.
Maybe. Maybe.
That'd be crazy. Yeah. Come on.
But yeah, I mean, talking about what Sega did right and wrong, obviously having the built-in modem was great, and having the low price point was great. That was a big thing. And by all accounts, I've only spoken to the guy and nobody else in Sega, of course, but according to Bernie Stolar, it was his doing that the Dreamcast came out at the lower price point and with the modem intact and not as an additional peripheral, which, if true, if he's to be believed, that's something to applaud him for, because the Dreamcast would be nothing if it wasn't for that modem and you had to buy it separately. Who would buy that separately if you had to spend, what, like another 50 quid on it? That's kind of a barrier to entry, right? So, but yeah, what did the Dreamcast do wrong in the early days? What did it not do so well, do we think, when it came out, when it launched in America and the European Union?
Well, I mean, we say that he's to be applauded for that decision, but definitely to be applauded for us as consumers, but you know, it didn't catch fire, did it? It wasn't the feature that made people think that they had to have it. And Sony hedged their bets and held out and released a peripheral later, which was seemingly the correct move. So I guess including the modem is arguably something that they did wrong at the beginning, because it just wasn't worth it, it seems.
I mean, advertising it as well for, was it up to 6 billion players and then only being playable across people in Europe? That was a bit of a...
Yeah,
I think they got them in hot water as well.
They did, right? Yeah. Off-gen or Ofcom or whoever it is, we're not particularly happy with the slogan.
Yeah, so...
It's a hard question to answer, though, Andrew, because you look at it and the obvious answer is always, oh, well, they didn't attract the right third parties. And you can actually, if you break that down, they actually did. I mean, a lot of the early games came from a lot of big, well-known third-party companies. And, you know, the obvious one is obviously they never had EA, which will always haunt them, I think. But I guess this is probably why the Dreamcast has become such a loved, iconic cult machine, is that it's really hard to pinpoint things that they actually did wrong. The price was good. The hardware was good. The functionality was good. The games were largely good and looked better than anything else that had existed. For the most part, they had most genres pretty well covered. Lack of a football soccer game in the UK, a good one, was obviously hugely detrimental. And it does, unfortunately, all come down to this whole... the wrong place, and more critically, the wrong time. It was just in that awkward point in console gaming history where, as we kind of alluded to already, people had been massively burnt by the Saturn, which was, you know, I know there's a lot of you that love the Saturn on here, but, you know, pound for pound against the PlayStation, got absolutely destroyed by it. Not to say there's not some amazing games on the Saturn, because obviously there are. People had lost a lot of faith in Sega by then, and as I said, you just cannot underestimate the power of that PlayStation brand at that point, certainly in the UK and Europe and in America as well at that point. And it was just a case of, you know, why do I want to buy this now when PS2 is going to give me my new tech and my new Ridge Racer, my new all this Final Fantasy, my new all this amazing stuff I've been playing. And as I said, you know, you look at Sega, they had an exclusive Resident Evil, for example, which was a title synonymous with PlayStation. They had was Tomb Raider exclusive on Dreamcast when it launched? I know it originally came out, but was 4 a Dreamcast launch exclusive at the time?
Chronicles? I don't think so. I don't think so.
No. But either way, it was the better version of it, and they included some exclusive stuff in it, but it wasn't exclusive to the Dreamcast.
So they had all these games, you know, and it was just... That's why it's so hard, I think, just to look back at it and say, what did they do wrong? Because it's, for me anyway, other than the obvious no DVD, which, again, in 98-99 was probably pushing it from a cost perspective, and you probably would have been adding at least $100 bucks onto the price of the console just because of the licenses you had to pay to have a DVD out of the box anyway, which Sony just kind of stomached because of the bigger game. So, yeah, it really is one of those kind of mysteries as to what they could have done better, because it's hard to pinpoint it.
Yeah, and I think that's all spot on. I mean, and I would add that they're just, I'm not sure there was anything Sega could really do at that point. I think once they've dug themselves into a hole, both with in a, terms of just losing their clout in the industry through, you know, the 32X and the Saturn, yeah, and all of the infighting between Sega of Japan and Sega of America, and just all of the times that they've had unforced errors and put themselves into a position of having to work from behind to make that up. I don't think there was anything they really could have done with the Dreamcast short of, I don't know. I mean, I think one of the things, and I do talk about this a little bit in the write-up I did for the upcoming Dreamcast year two book. And that's Sega, more or less, for all of their innovations that they did in the online space and everything that you had outlined, they very much stuck to their guns as far as producing the types of games that they always had and that they were best at. But the problem is that the types of arcade experiences that they excelled at were still very niche and becoming even more so. And, you know, in the face of big RPG blockbusters and, you know, first-person shooters like Half-Life or GoldenEye, like they, you know, they weren't really chasing those segments of the market that were growing fastest. And so I think that was also kind of hamstringing some of their ability to catch up, even if they were still getting the odd, you know, exclusive or timed exclusive Resident Evil mixed in there.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Just one more thing to add. I know I've spoken a lot about this, but I would just say, like, the biggest issue you could probably pinpoint is the timing of it all. But they had to go when they did. If they'd left it any longer, then it probably would have even sold even less if they'd left it another 12 months, because by that point people would have just said, no, I'm just going to get the PS2. So they had to launch when they did, and so you can't even fault them for making the decision to push it when they did rather than wait a bit longer and then sort of be this in between generation. So yeah. Just feel sorry for them.
Yeah.
If they waited any longer, it would have been the Microsoft Dreamcast.
Yeah. Very true.
Very true.
I mean, by all accounts, they did push the launch several times, especially in Europe. So, I mean, we were meant to launch the same time as America, which would have been pretty interesting, because we don't often get launches, or back then we didn't get launches at the same time as other countries. It was always Europe last, or Australia last, sorry, we were second to last. So we were meant to go on the 9th of the 9th, 99, but was it October 14th that we ended up launching at? And of course it was 9th of the 9th in America. Out of all of us here then, who got one of the consoles at launch?
I did.
James, are you nodding there?
I was launch window. So I got one on my birthday, which is November 10th, because I couldn't afford it on launch. So I had the last 50 quid off my parents, my birthday, that I needed to buy it on launch on my birthday. So I was a month behind. But I always call myself launch. But yeah, I'm a month out.
Yeah, we'll give you that. Rich, you were launch as well, weren't you?
I was launch day, yeah. I actually originally had a dentist appointment on the 23rd of September, and then when it got delayed, I actually moved the dentist appointment to 14th of October, so I could have the day off school, and I spent the whole day just playing it. And it was terrific, yeah, good times.
I didn't get mine until August 2000, so I can't really speak much about the Dreamcast in 1999. And Steve, I want to come to you just a bit, because obviously you didn't own a Dreamcast yourself. What I want to ask you, though, is was it ever in your mind to buy one, or was it? Yeah, I guess that's the question. Was it ever in your mind to buy one?
Yeah, I definitely wanted one for sure. Mm-hmm. I mean, I played the fuck out of yours because I loved it so much. But that kind of thing was not really in my control at the time. So, yeah, it was never really on the cards for me being able to buy one. I had to wait to get a PS2 instead, because, I just didn't have any money of my own. So I had to rely on it being bought for me, and that wasn't going to happen. So I just kind of had to accept that wasn't going to happen.
That's fair. That's fair enough. Do you have any memories from that time of kind of looking at it and looking at the launch? Was it anything that any of the games that particularly stood out to you in terms of wanting to play it, or was PlayStation just really all you needed at the time?
I remember the Sonic Adventure is the thing that sticks out to me the most. Mm-hmm. That looked incredible. I was a Sonic fan. I'm still a Sonic fan, but back then, super fan. And seeing the whale destroying the bridge behind Sonic, just, yeah, it was insane. I desperately, desperately wanted one.
Yeah.
But yeah, it was just, I had to cover it. I was never going to get my hands on one of my own, sadly.
Yeah, it's a shame. But at least you got to play mine, and one of our mutual friends had one as well. So always the opportunity there. It's a story that I hear so often, though. It's always, because so few people actually bought a Dreamcast, you know, it's less than 10 million in, you know, in the whole world who bought a Dreamcast, which, you know, considering the amount of people there are, that's very few. So I hear so many stories of people who played their friend's Dreamcast because they didn't get their own. I mean, I think that must be quite a common thing.
I've got a really funny story that I said earlier on, I was obsessed with the launch of Dreamcast, and I was going on, I was just building up to it. Even though I didn't get one on launch day, I was building up and building up, couldn't wait for it to come out. And I can remember it vividly now. On my room, on my pin board, I had like some of the brochures that you'd pick up, or leaflets you pick up from Game and Virgin and Game Station and all the other, or Electronics Boutique and all the others. And my best mate, the guy who I stole the keyboard from eventually, I was just banging on at him for constantly telling him, you've got to buy a Dreamcast. Mm-hmm. And the reason he bought one was because I kept going on about it so much, as in, so we could have games to swap with each other and whatnot. So I feel like I did my part in helping Sega, you know, sell those launch window consoles. He also had a copy of Shenmue, which I borrowed off him, which probably started my whole, you know, distaste for the series from that point onwards. So,
James, you talked earlier about your friend getting their Dreamcast and it being their main sort of internet device. I hope you waited a while before stealing their keyboard.
Yeah, it was after he'd sold it. So he'd sold sold his Dreamcast to buy a PS2, and he was like, "Oh, I didn't sell my keyboard or something. Do you want it?" And I was like, I don't even know why, because I was playing, because I did play online back in the day. I played a lot of Phantasy Star Online and Toy Racer, but I didn't really ever use the keyboard back in the day. I just was used to using the online one. I guess when you're in your bedroom at home on your bed, it's quite difficult to kind of have that setup going on. So I just had it off him, and then it ended up just in my Dreamcast in the box up in the attic. And since I got my Dreamcast back online 2 years ago, I've given it probably more use now than it's ever had in its entire existence.
I mean, we are going to talk about some of the games that launched in 1999 for Dreamcast, of course. Before we do that, just briefly, 1999 for the Dreamcast, really, in the West, was at most 3 months. There's only 3 months of games released. Of course, there were games that were released in Japan, but for the most part, they're, from what I can see anyway, they're mostly forgettable. There's a few things in Alley Kitty and a few other bits and bobs, Seaman, but that would come to the US later, of course. But we didn't get that many games. I think there was probably around about 30 to 35 games in 1999. Was the Dreamcast something you bought a lot of games for, guys, before in 1999, or was it just a case of getting a couple of the games and kind of waiting till later?
Oh, go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, I mean, I only got a couple of games on launch, and I think I'm probably the remainder of that year, I probably got a few games for that Christmas. Otherwise, I probably didn't buy anything until later in 2000 that I can recall.
Yeah, I had a lot of demos.
After
using all of my money to buy my Dreamcast console, poor old me couldn't afford any games until Christmas. So I was basically playing demo discs until Christmas Day, and I had Virtua Fighter and Monaco Grand Prix on Christmas Day. So I was very much repeating demos for a month and a half until that point.
You got better games for Christmas than me. I chose Chef's Love Shack, so that's not a bad game, is it?
Yeah, that's my situation is pretty similar. I had been looking forward to the Dreamcast all summer, saved my money for it, was salivating over. I was hyped over literally every game I would find in EGM, and then ultimately Sonic Adventure was the catalyst for me buying it, and that was the only game I bought on launch day, and it's the only game I had until Christmas. So I did play a lot back in the day. And then ultimately, for Christmas, I think I got Soul Calibur, NFL 2K, and Sega Rally 2. So
So Brian's had the best haul so far, which by far.
I mean,
if somebody's winning that, and then Brian is. Yeah,
fair enough. I mean, depending on how much you would have tolerated Sonic Adventure or 3 months of Sonic Adventure and nothing else. But yeah, we rented a lot of games too. I would have rented pretty much every game on the shelf at the local video stores. So
yeah,
games rental. Wow.
Back then, I was actually like super forced. Like I was super like excited and thought Sonic Adventure was really, really great because you wanted it to be Mario 64 for the Dreamcast, but with Sonic. It's only really retrospectively if you go back and play it, it's like it actually plays like garbage. Whereas if you go back and play Mario 64 now, it's still one of the best games ever made, even now. Whereas yeah, the controls on Sonic Adventure are just hideous. But yeah, at the time I loved it. I thought it was amazing, and I played that demo with that first level with the whale about 100 times.
Still good. That's still good.
To look at visually, I still think it looks fantastic.
But it is the only good part in that game. It turns out.
Yeah, I'll get a little bit into how my thoughts on that have. Gosh, it's been a roller coaster ride for my perceptions of Sonic Adventure over the years. And if you ask me, like. Two weeks ago, even what I thought of it, I'd be like, yeah, it's a garbage game. I have a fondness for it. But I actually, in the last week, I replayed it in its entirety from start to finish with all the characters. And I got to say, the things that are bad don't bug me as much. And I'll get into my thoughts on it a little bit. But it's actually, I feel like I've come around and I enjoy it a lot more than I have over the last 20 years. It's crazy.
To be fair, I think that's probably a good segue into Sonic Adventure. I mean, this is what we're going to do now, of course. I'll just explain. So on Dreamcast years, what we generally do is I pick eight games and we talk through them and we decide whether they were game changers, if they were just kind of, you know, just it's just a game, or if it was a bit shit. So we're going to do that here. But instead of me drafting the list, I've asked everybody to come up with two games that they want to chat about. And so Brian, James, Steve and Rich are going to pick two games each. And if we've got time, I'll throw in one of my own at the end. So Brian, let's just do this now. Sonic Adventure, come on, thoughts. I mean, we've had lots of thoughts already. Let's go deeper into it.
Where do we start here? Because I feel like it runs the gamut of being just a game, kind of okay, but also an incredibly shitty game. But also one that I think was a game changer and continues to be, just through its sheer ambition and charm that it's somehow retained through today. And like I said, it was the reason I bought the Dreamcast. So even, you know, over all this time where I like kind of dismissed Sonic Adventure as a garbage, you know, kind of a dumpster fire, I still respected the fact that it got me involved or interested in the console as well as the medium as a serious hobby. But I, you know, yeah, it's no secret that it fails in infinite ways, which I'm sure everybody here can kind of continue piling on if you want to. I would just say that, the thing I found when replaying it last week is that it remains surprisingly charming despite and often because of some of its quirks. And I think the heart of that charm is in its ambition. And when we think about what Sonic Team attempted with that game, they threw a lot of stuff at the wall. Like this is a game that had intertwining narratives through the perspectives of six different characters that were all like very cross-genre-y, like separate, you know, gameplay styles and entire sets of mechanics, plus all the mini games that they were all part of. And then, you know, all of this was set in the adventure hub areas, the Station Square and Mystic Ruins, which I think is probably one of my favorite parts of the game today, particularly in how all of the virtual community of NPCs all have something to say. And as you go through the adventure, they all have their own interests and personal drama and just, I don't know, spicy views on politics that just unfold as the events of the game do. And I just feel like that's one of my favorite parts of the game that's held up the best. Plus there's the Chao Garden, which my partner in crime, Katie, would argue, and very correctly, that it's probably the core progression system driving both Sonic Adventure and Sonic Adventure 2. But it's like, it's that thing that kind of that's the glue between all of the pieces that you can come back to and upgrade, you know, raise your chow and collect rings and buy new stuff and make them more and bring back animals from playing the stages, which, you know, honestly, yeah, there's a handful of decent Sonic stages that are worth replaying, and everything else is, yeah, it's bad, but honestly not as bad as I expected. So yeah, anyway, as much as it fails, I really feel there's a charm in how all of it comes together to be something more than the sum of its various janky, flawed parts, I guess is what I'll say.
Very diplomatic. Very diplomatic indeed. I'm sure some other people here won't be quite as diplomatic. Who wants to go next?
I mean,
go on, Rich.
Sure. Okay. Yeah. I mean, I loved it in a weird way. I mean, it was the big game for me at launch, and even then, I knew it wasn't Mario 64, but I kind of went into it with that mindset. It was like the big. Okay, it's difficult to say killer app, but it was like the big marquee game. It was a character I grew up with on the Mega Drive. I did have a real love and affinity for Sonic, so. Yeah, that was the big game for me on launch, and I persevered through some of the things that didn't work, but what was done well, I mean, yeah, there are still things about that game that in a weird way hold up today, but 85-90% of it is janky, a janky mess. But yeah, I've got a special place in my heart, definitely, and that Crash 40 soundtrack still rules as well.
Yeah, for sure.
I think it's fair to say that it was definitely a game changer for Sega, because don't forget, at the time, we hadn't seen a new Sonic game, a new good Sonic game, really, since, what, Sonic 3, probably, or Sonic & Knuckles, whichever one.
Was, Sonic R, so. Yeah, same thing. Same
yeah,
thing.
Yeah. You know, obviously, the Saturn never had a proper Sonic game, so it was a long time coming, and I think there was definitely a lot of sort of a lot of hype built up around that. I think, you know, it is controversial to say, and there's plenty of people who will turn around and say, well, retrospectively, you go and play Sonic 1, 2, 3, and retrospectively, they don't really hold up well nowadays anyway. Some will argue completely the opposite. I'm the same as you guys. I grew up with Sega. I was never a Nintendo kid, or I did have them, but never had an affinity with Mario games. I was always more of a Sonic guy, so I loved them. But I can also see the argument for why, you know, you can play Super Mario World nowadays and really revel in the level design and the controls and everything, whereas you play Sonic 1, and yes, it brings back some great memories, but, you know, it's not exactly a masterpiece of platforming. And I think that's the biggest problem with Sonic Adventure, is that it's the style of gameplay, this whole, you know, get to the end as quick as you can, it's meant to be a bit wild, it's meant to be a bit edgy. That was the whole vibe that Sonic brought to the table in the 90s, right? It was meant to be that edgy, fast, do things a bit different. And it just doesn't translate well to a 3D environment. And the fact that, you know, we're in 2021 and they still haven't made a 3D Sonic game that you could really say is absolutely amazing and does the series justice, just kind of sort of says that, really. But similarly, at the time, you know, again, I wanted Sega to succeed. I was a huge Sonic fan. I couldn't wait for it. I thought it was great, and I put up with it at the time. But it's, as I said, for me, it's retrospectively looking back at it. And you know, I'm afraid if you look at, and I hate to compare the two because they are very different, but, you know, you have to put, you know, make the case that Mario 64 is always compared to it because that was Mario's leap from 2D to 3D, and it has not only stood the test of time as a good Mario game, it still is arguably one of the most enjoyable platform games to play in 3D nowadays. Whereas, as you guys said, you know, yeah. Sonic, you can play it, you can have a good time with it, you can have a lot of nostalgia memory for it, but you can't really call it a well executed game. If we're just talking technically. So I do think it is a game changer for Sega. I do think it brought a lot to the table that Sonic hadn't done for a long time. But yeah, retrospectively, it's nothing more than a game for me. It's an iconic piece of Dreamcast history, but it's not a game that I would be using as a showpiece for the console.
Steve, what about you?
Yeah, I mean, I grew up with Sega. I was a big Sonic fan. I'm not going to pretend that I played Sonic Adventure at the time and was like, oh, this is a low quality. No. Like, I loved it, right? Because it was Sonic, but it was in 3D, and that was enough. It didn't take too long, though, for me to realize that it was had problems. And it didn't take too long for me to realize that basically they just didn't really know what to do with Sonic in 3D. And arguably, they still don't know what to do with Sonic in 3D. The original games, as James was saying, it's get from one end to the other really, really fast. It was Sonic is a designed by committee mascot anyway, designed purely to compete with Nintendo. And so it was a pretty shallow concept. And anyway, they were just, look how fast this is. That's all it was. That
blast
said,
processing.
I think, yeah, exactly. Blast, blast processing. It's very well presented. It looks great. The music is fantastic, but as a game, pretty shallow concept, and you can't really do get from one end to the other as fast as you can in 3D because you are just wasting assets. As like, you can't generate enough assets. You can't draw them fast enough. So what the hell do you do with it? And their answer was Sonic Adventure, and it doesn't work at all. I mean, I'm not going to go into the myriad of reasons why it does not, but like, they can't decide what perspective the game should be. And when the game decides it's from another perspective, it throws your controls off. The cutscenes are hilariously bad. I don't like this game very much, but I'm not gonna kick it to death here on this pod. But it's a bit shit, really, isn't it?
I mean, just to briefly say my thoughts on it, pretty much match James and Steve's. It's not. I mean, I've never been a particularly big Sonic fan. I was a Nintendo person growing up, then I was Sony, and then I was Sega. So Sonic never really factored into my childhood per se. So Sonic Adventure never really interested me at the time, and I've played it since, and it's okay. Sonic Adventure 2 is better in my eyes. But if we're going to rate it, then if it's a game changer, a game, or a bit shit, Rich, what are you going to go for?
I do want to say a light game changer. It's the best I can do, I'm afraid. I don't think it's fair to just rule it as a game.
Okay.
But yeah, it's a difficult one. I don't think it's changed the industry like Mario did. Mm-hmm. But I'm always going to be a Sonic guy over Mario, so I'm going to lean more towards game changer.
Fair enough. All right, Brian, what about you?
I kind of alluded to it a little bit when I was talking about it, but I would say that those three categories may not be mutually exclusive. And I do think it was a bit shit in many ways and continues to be. But I would also say that in the ways that it's shit don't really matter that much. It still has the charm to be a very interesting and ambitious and just quirky or just oddly endearing game in a way that makes all of the individual flaws or all of the ways that it fails maybe not moot, but certainly less prohibitive to enjoying it, or at least for me. If you asked me 2 weeks ago, I would have just said it was shit and left it there, but just replaying it recently, it's kind of turned me around a bit on it. And also, for all the ways it fails, I think it's worth just respect it, just the fact that it did so much to put itself in a position to even fail in all of the distinct myriad ways it did. Not a lot of games attempt to do half of the stuff that Sonic Adventure did as far as implementing so many different genres and concepts into one game that all just kind of fed into each other, system-wise and mechanics-wise. So, yeah, game changer on that front as well. So yeah, it's hard. It's complicated for me. I gotta say all three if I can.
I mean, I guess that makes it a game though, right? Because if it's all three, you have to meet in the middle somewhere. So
yeah, but it's a lot more. I would say that it's a lot more than just a game.
Okay.
Like it's a shitty game. It's like a game I would say is like, it's average. It's whatever. It didn't do much. It didn't do anything interesting. But just by all of the risks it did take, I feel like it can't really be just a game.
Okay.
It has to be both shit and a game changer. Shitty game changer.
That's a new one.
Wow.
James, what about you?
Despite everything I've said, I have to say it was a game changer purely because it turned out that the execution wasn't particularly bad. Looking at all the Sonic games that have come since, with the exception maybe of Sonic Adventure 2, I think they probably did the best job they could at converting a game that wasn't really convertible to our registered trademark convertible to 3D. And I think, as I alluded to earlier on, however you slice it, it was a game changer for Sega. They had to do it. This was their final push to get any sort of traction in the industry. So they had to have a Sonic game. They had to have a 3D game. It had to be huge. And it, to be, you know, to sing its praises, it was huge. It had so much variety. Execution wasn't great, but it was a game changer as far as bringing Sonic into 3D. And as I said, you could argue that it's never been bettered from a Sega, from a Sonic in 3D perspective.
Cool. Okay. Steve, what about you?
That part with the killer whale is real good. Mm-hmm. It's really good. But then it's almost like a tech demo, right? And it did its job because it's very impressive. Mere moments after that, however, there is a loop-the-loop, which is frustratingly difficult to nail first time. You just end up zipping off the side and flying out into the ocean. With the greatest respect to both Brian and James, I think they make very valid points. I personally can't see it. I think it's the first example of them not knowing what to do with Sonic, and it is a pit from which they have still not managed to climb out. And yeah. I just think it's a bit shit.
Oh, so not even a game. We're going right down to shit.
I'm afraid so, yeah.
Somebody had to say it. All right. I mean, my vote would have, I would have gone to the whole, because I don't like it. It's not my kind of game, and I would say it's shit. But also, I can appreciate the game-changing nature of it, and I'd have just plonked it straight in the middle of the game. But we've got three people saying game-changer, so a game-changer it is. There you go. Or a shitty game-changer, if we really want to take what Brian says.
I like that. I like it. It works.
Shitty game-changer.
Yeah.
Let's go with that. All right, next game on the list is Rich's game. Rich, what are you bringing to the table first?
Ooh, I'm going for the nice ironic pick, but I think this one holds up. I'm going for Dynamite Cop.
Ooh. Okay, tell us about it.
Kind of like Sonic Adventure in a way. It's not necessarily a good game, but it's got a very special place in my heart. It's basically the gaming equivalent of like a drunk uncle. It's just completely off its tits, mad. Like, it's completely just bizarre, and I love it. So yeah, it started off life as a sequel to Die Hard Arcade, but without the license. And it's a 3D beat-em-up set aboard a cruise liner that's been taken over by modern-day pirates, one of which has a crustacean on his head. They are pirates in the truest sense of the word, and some of the bad guys wear crab shells and shark fins for what reason I do not know. And it's just amazing. Completely out of its mind, mad, and I love it. It's not the longest game. It's probably, to play it from start to finish, it's about 20 to 30 minutes.
What?
Yeah, truly. Yeah, I mean, it was the last Dreamcast game I actually completed, and I forgot how short it was. And it's, it's kind of underwhelming in that respect. But you do have three different characters, and I think there are three different routes. So you can actually bump that up to 90 minutes if you are all about longevity. The weapons in it are crazy. Other than like fists and guns and knives, you can use hairspray, fish, and there's even baguettes as well. I can't put into words how crazy this game is, even down to like the instruction manual. The bios for like the characters that you control, they are just weird. And we all remember gaming manuals. That's a thing of the past. And it just kind of completed the package because they described the characters as Captain Bruno, who's described as a one tough ball of primate carrying beefcake. You've got Sergeant Ivy, whose turnoffs are small feet and mean people who want to take over the world. And then there's Corporal Brown, who's apparently he moonlights as a psychic advice line. He moonlights as someone on a psychic advice line when he's not saving the world. It's just the weirdest game. There's real good, like, almost Hollywood-esque, like, cinematic scoring in it. There's QTE events. It's just the weirdest game. and I find it so charming. And it's a game I never played because I do believe it came out and launch with the Dreamcast in Europe, but I completely dismissed it at the time. And then I played the demo of it with one of the magazines, and I just fell in love with it. And playing it recently on the GDMU, I think it's fantastic. It's a complete eccentric wild mess, and it's a very short one, but I love it. It speaks to me in its own weird way. I love it.
I'm looking at some screenshots on Google, and first off, it looks like a rich game.
It does.
It also very much looks like a Dreamcast game.
It does.
In the best kind of way, I mean.
Uh-huh. Yeah, fair. Brian, any thoughts on this one?
Yeah, I don't know. I would echo everything Rich said. I absolutely love Dynamite Cop. To preface that, I played a ton of Die Hard Arcade or Dynamite Deca, the first game in that quote-unquote series, for the Saturn as well. And so I already kind of loved it going into it, and I was already had a soft spot for that type of game, which, in my opinion, Dynamite Cop was maybe the pinnacle of like what or the culmination of everything that beat 'em ups were working towards in a 3D space. And it's like, oh yeah, that's probably the best it got as far as in 3D. After that, I feel like they just didn't make a lot of those types of games. And even by the time Dynamite Cop came out, that genre had kind of fallen out of favor for a little bit. So reviews were all over the place and very mixed at the time. But I think that is a game that over time, we kind of look back as a community a little more fondly of, that I've noticed. Cause I don't think we're the only ones who enjoy that game, but yeah, I absolutely love it. And I routinely will play it. I'll play through it every like 6 months or so. It's really good.
Nice. Steve, looking at screenshots, and I'm guessing you haven't played this one?
I haven't, no. I mean, I've heard of it, of course, and I was aware of the Die Hard connection, although I wasn't exactly sure what that meant, so that's just been linked in my head. But no, I never played this one. It sounds bonkers, though, So I would like to.
Fair enough. We have to somehow get you to play that game. Mm-hmm. James, is this one you've played?
Yep, similar to Rich, I played the demo a lot extensively when it was on one of the very early Dreamcast, I think maybe I want to say the second magazine disc that came out with Buggy Heat, with the two playable demos on that one, if memory serves me well. I played the demo a lot, which was probably about 25% of the game. But it was, it's one of those games, I think I would have been really pissed off if I'd used one of my what would have been a quarterly game purchase on this game. For as much fun as it was, as we've alluded to, it's over pretty quickly. But it's a game that I've played through in recent years rather than at the time. The demo was kind of enough for me back then. But it doesn't do anything amazing. As has been alluded to, the kind of side-scrolling beat-em-up genre was slowly fading out by this point. Realistically, this is as close as we ever got to Streets of Rage 4 on Dreamcast, and it did really well.
I've enjoyed the small amount of time. I did not realize that it was a 30-minute game, so I wish I'd pushed a bit harder, because I think I got 10 minutes in, and I was like, this is fun and everything, but I'm going to turn it off for now. And knowing that there was only 20 more minutes to go, I really should have just pushed on for the extra 20 minutes. For me, on that basis, it's just a game, really. I can't say it's shit because I did enjoy what I played. Rich, is this a game changer for you, or is it just a game?
Even though it's my pick, it's still just a solid game. I love it, and that's the reason. It's not meant to change the world, it's not gonna sell a console, it's not redefining a genre, but it's like the kind of thing that someone made especially for me. It's why I love the Yakuza series now, because it's such a weird eccentricity to it, and it's just bizarre when it wants to be, which is in the case of this game, all of it's 30 minutes. Yes, it's a game. It's a big old game, nothing more, nothing less.
Fair enough. Brian?
I agree. I think it's a great game. The only case I could make for it being a game changer is just because it wasn't really topped since its release, as far as 3D beat 'em ups go in that genre. So in a way, it was a logical endpoint to what the genre had been building towards in a 3D space. But yeah, it's a game. It's like, I don't want to fool my, I'm not going to try to fool myself there. It's a good game. And that's about it, which
Very
is
fair.
Still saying a lot, like, you know, yeah. Do play it if you haven't already. So yeah, yes. Steve, you should definitely pick it up.
Yeah. On that note, Steve, what would you say this is, the person who hasn't played it?
Oh, I mean, I can only really say game, really, can't I? Yeah. No, I definitely want to check this one out. I need to find a way. I need to find a way.
James, what about you?
Yeah, it's a game, and I'm trying to work out if there are any other PAL launch games that go for more money than this one, because this one's quite an expensive one, and I don't think there's any launch games that go for much more than this.
Yeah,
off the top of my head, anyway. But yeah, definitely worth playing if you have a GDMU or similar. Yeah, it's good to check on a Sunday afternoon, but it is nothing more than a good old fun half hour to an hour's worth of gameplay. It's a game.
Yeah, yeah. I'm glad I didn't pay, because it's what, about £30-35 now?
Oh, it's more than that. It's creeping up to 50, I think, isn't it?
Really?
For a fully boxed and manual, I think you'd probably be looking at £50 off the top of my head for a PAL copy.
Wow.
Yeah, it's even more expensive here, I think.
Really? That's crazy. I'm glad. I think I picked it for like a tenner from a Play Expo a few years back, so I'm pretty glad I got it.
Yeah, same.
Back then. All right, moving on. James, what's the first game that you're going to bring to the table?
You'd be unsurprised to hear, Andrew, it's a racing game. Uh-huh. I have picked Racing Simulation Monaco Grand Prix because it was the game that I had on launch, and pre-launch it was the demo that I played most of. It was on the Dream On disc that was bundled with the console. Obviously a huge racing fan. I mean, ever since PlayStation, really, when 3D racing games properly actually started becoming good, and that was what I invested most of my time in. Being a huge Formula One fan, I think probably 50% of my PlayStation library were Formula One games. And it was great to play these things. And obviously you had a keen eye on Monaco Grand Prix on the Dreamcast pre-launch. Was, again, disappointed as a Formula One fan that it didn't have the licenses, the full license. But it did feel like the most... and I'll use the terms in speech marks, most simulation version of Formula Racing on a console that we'd seen up to this point. Because obviously PlayStation racing games, as good as they were, as good fun as they were, and may have called themselves simulators, they were quite primitive in the handling stakes. Whereas on the with Monaco, you had the Grand Prix mode that was you know, it's pretty tough. It was, I mean, it's no simulation now, but looking back on it, it was still pretty difficult to do well in, which I loved that sort of challenge. Didn't have a license, which was disappointing, as I said. It did have an editor, so you could edit all the team names and all the driver names, which I absolutely did. But obviously you didn't have the livery editor or anything like that, which was a letdown. I think that was ultimately what went against it in the reviews. But apart from that, great graphics, great gameplay. Obviously all the tracks that you'd expect from a Formula One game, and it actually had a retro racing mode as well, which is probably where my love for Spirit of Speed ultimately came from. But yeah, one of those games I think that just kind of went under the radar as a launch game, because when people wanted a racing game, most of them went to Speed Devils or Sega Rally or one of those. And obviously Formula One games, certainly back in the late 90s, were a lot more niche than they are these days, with it being a lot less popular a sport. But it was one of the games that, as I said, I played the demo extensively and then must have done multiple championships on the full version when it came out. And yeah, just one that really, really resonated with me, and something that I always look back fondly on now.
Cool. I own this now, because I think I picked up in a bundle of games, but I've not played it. And just to clarify, so it's called Monaco Grand Prix, but you allude to the fact that there are multiple tracks. For some reason I thought it was just going to be Monaco. No, I'm guessing it's not.
So they obviously, Monaco itself is a license, because mm-hmm. If you have an unlicensed version, it would just be the Monte Carlo Grand Prix. So randomly, they do have a license for certain sponsors and places. So Monaco Grand Prix is such a weird thing, because it's like, obviously there's Sega Monaco Grand Prix as well, which is a big series in the 90s. It's nothing at all to do with that. So yeah, it's called Monaco Grand Prix, but it does have the full roster of tracks. Mm-hmm. And yeah, they do have some real world sponsors, so like Bridgestone and Schweppes, I think, was one of them. And they're literally a handful of real life sponsors from back in the day. But it's based on the 1997 season, I believe. So yeah, you can make, but even all the overlays on the screen and stuff, they all kind of mirror what the TV overlays looked like back in the day. So yeah, I think you've got to be a real racing fan to enjoy the game, because presentation wise, it's not particularly particularly hot. And then of course there was the super duper rare version of Monaco Grand Prix that was released a couple of years later, which I know falls out of our 1999 remit, but it was the online version of the game, yeah, which randomly came out in PAL territories only in like 2001. So God knows how many single digit copies they actually ended up selling. and yeah, but it's great. It's back online now, so it's great fun to play online now.
Amazing. It's really cool. Brian, is this one that you've played?
It is. Yeah, I think I last played it about 6 months or so ago when I was preparing for an article on the Junkyard. Basically, I went and more or less just rambled about or ranked all of the North American launch games, because I was posting it around $9.99 to commemorate that anniversary. And this was, I think, the one launch game that I couldn't really get into, and not because I thought it was a bad game. For whatever reason, I don't think my brain can manage the physics system, and because I would constantly just spin out or end up in the grass. And it was just really hard for me, coming from a background where I would love, you know, arcade racers and other maybe more forgiving simulation style games. This one doesn't hold your hand, even with as many of the aids and stuff as I could find. It still didn't really help. I think I won like two races and I called that good. I was like, yep, that's about as good as I'm gonna do. That felt rewarding, but overall, I respect that this is probably for the time a really good simulation. I thought it was a very chill game. I liked the vibe a lot, and it almost reminded me later on, like a Test Drive Le Mans, when that came out, and just really nailed that tone of having kind of a techno soundtrack and just very chill presentation and whatnot. But yeah, it was really tough for me to get into, but I respect it. I definitely respect it.
Fair enough. Fair enough. Steve, I feel like you're taking on Rich's role today. Have you played this game?
Steve. Nope.
I'm looking at the screenshots. It looks okay. It's the kind of thing that I would have a go on now, but I don't think I could have been less interested at the time. So on this, I shall have to defer to our esteemed colleagues, I'm afraid.
Okay, Rich.
This is a game I feel quite guilty about, because I've never really much cared for it, and I will hold my hands up and say that I'm a bit of a snob. I always have been when it comes to the unlicensed games. yeah, I know. It's weird. but there's something about the way it played. I never really liked the handling. I did appreciate it was more of a simulation, but I was way more into what came the following month with a video system and F1 World Grand Prix. That was my jam. I love that game. So I never, beyond the demo and maybe a brief bit with it on the GDMU, I've never really played this game. I never really cared for it. Yeah, didn't like the lack of license, didn't like the way it felt, didn't like the way it looked. Just something about it. I don't know. I was much bigger fan of, like I said, F1 World Grand Prix, much bigger fan of the likes of Kart, Flag to Flag. They're my kind of games. Never liked Monaco Racing Simulation, and maybe I should give it another go, because it's sitting on my console downstairs, and yeah. I'll give it a play this weekend, and we'll see how I feel after that.
if you want it with a license, they did release F-1, which really annoys me. F-1, I think World Championship is called, which is basically the exact same game, but with a 1999 F1 license on it, which is
the best season as well. So awesome. I'd like to play that.
Well, I'll argue with you that it was the best season.
Oh, but,
it wasn't 97, so it definitely wasn't. But yeah, it was. If you want to play it with a license, definitely go for that one, because it is literally the same game, but with a skin on it.
Sounds like we need to get Three Pricks and a Podcast back up and running, just so James and Rich can argue F1. Anyway, moving on. Is it a game changer, everybody? Rich, come on, game changer.
Nah, game. It's a game.
Game. James?
I think it's just a game. I mean, I could make a case for it being a game changer in that I really don't think there is a console racing F1 game that came before it that had anywhere near the level of realism that it brought to the table. But and I think had it had an official license on launch, I probably would have called it a game changer. But for that reason, it's just a game.
Fair enough. Steve?
Yeah, I mean, like I said, I have to defer to the chaps here. I'll just go with game.
Fair enough. Brian?
Also game.
Also game. I will concur. So just a game. But, you know, that's fine. That's all right. At least it's not shit. moving on then to our next game. Steve, what do you want to talk about?
I would like to talk about House of the Dead 2. Mm. If we want to talk about games having shit elements that simply add to their charm, House of the Dead 2 is the one. It was the arcade that I used to see all the time in arcades when they were still a thing, and think that it was the most incredible thing I'd ever seen. It looked amazing. I was also like, how can they just have that out in an arcade when you're blowing holes in zombies really graphically and violently? The destruction of the enemies was super impressive. It was a light gun game, obviously. And then with the sort of the general noise and clamor of an arcade, you could sort of just barely hear the really awesome music and the voices and stuff like that. So then when it came out on Dreamcast, obviously we talked earlier on about how the Dreamcast isn't like strictly an arcade perfect machine, but this game felt like it was arcade perfect, and it felt really, really special to be able to play this on Dreamcast. I think the Dreamcast light gun, did that thing have a name?
It's just the Dreamcast gun, I think.
There
was the Dream Blaster, which was third party, but I think.
Yeah, I had the Mad Cats.
The Dreamcast gun. Yeah, there you go.
Dreamcast gun. It doesn't. You don't need more than that, right? That's clear. That's clear what
Dream
that is.
Dream gun. There you go. That's perfect.
And I thought it was rad. The way the VMU slotted into the back, it felt like you were slapping a clip into it, which was awesome. Yeah, and it played what felt like exactly like the arcade on the Dreamcast, except the noise and the din of the arcade was gone, and you could hear all of the music and all of the voices in all of their glory. And the voice acting in this game is legendarily terrible, and it absolutely adds to its charm. I absolutely love the voice acting in this game. I'm convinced, I don't know this for sure, so I can't find any credits for who voiced this game online, but I'm convinced that this was just the developers or people for whom English is not their first language, right? Because there's no Japanese voice tracks for this game. It is always in English. And I think they were just going for like an American style movie. So they did American voices, and they're like, the tone and the intonation of the things that people are saying are just completely wrong. There's a guy. So it's a light gun game on rails. You shoot zombies. There's not a lot to say, really. You pick up power ups. You fight bosses, which become like light gun puzzles where you've got to find the weak spot and shoot the specific areas. And it's really graphic for the time, although all the blood's green. But like the destruction of the bodies is incredibly graphic, and it's just a lot of fun. And it's really fast paced, and it's great. But the you can also save survivors. Well, they're not survivors if you don't save them. You can save sort of civilians. There's a guy who goes like, no, help me. What? Oh, no, don't come. Don't come. It's amazing, and I absolutely love it. Yeah. There's loads of cutscenes in there as well, which I think are supposed to be full of like pathos and drama, but they're just hilariously bad. These people are not voice actors, but it's great, and it absolutely adds to its charm. It's not a particularly long game either. I think me and you blasted through it a few times together. Yeah. It's just great. It's just a lot of fun. It's pure sort of arcade thrills, and as I said repeatedly, hilarious to listen to. It's very quotable, this game.
It is, for sure. I kind of want to come to Brian next, because I just want to mention the fact that so that we mentioned the Dreamcast Gun, of course, and it was developed by Sega specifically to look very un-gun-like. It was meant to look like a toy because of some of the issues that had been had in the past. I think this was not long after Columbine had happened.
Yeah.
So they developed it, and then they never released it in America, right? You didn't actually get the official Dreamcast Gun over there.
I don't believe so, no. I mean, we got a number of third-party ones, but I don't think the official Dreamcast Gun was ever released here.
No, which is weird, considering they developed it specifically to look as least gun-like as possible.
Yeah, but... or at least if it was, I didn't see it in stores. I always saw the Mad Catz one, which I had. I saw the big Hurricane one from Interact. But yeah, I never really saw the Sega one if it ever did come out here.
Yeah. What are your thoughts on House of the Dead 2?
I honestly can't really add anything to what Steve said. I think it's a fantastic game. It's a real good one of those, is what I would say. Probably my favorite light gun game maybe ever, or at least maybe of that time. I mean, I liked Time Crisis 2 as well, but of course Virtua Cop 2 a lot, but it's in the whatever that top tier is of light gun games of the era. It's certainly in them, is what I would say.
Yeah, very true. James, are you going to be writing a book about the top light gun games for the Dreamcast? Is this going to be at the top of that list?
Well, it'd be a very short list, wouldn't it? Confidential Miss, Submission, Virtua Cop 2,
yeah.
House of Dead,
Crimson OX.
Death Crimson OX and 2. Yeah, that's pretty much all I can think of. No, I'm not, but I love this game. So same best friend as earlier who had a Dreamcast. I always remember he had the PlayStation 1 gun with Time Crisis and Point Blank, and we'd play it all the time. And we actually had an arcade, a Mega Bowl, that was really close to where we lived. And we used to go down to Mega Bowl with like literally a pound in our pocket and have to pick what we were going to play. And it was normally Time Crisis or House of the Dead 2. And we were obsessed with that. And when it came out on Dreamcast, again, it was that whole, was it you, Steve, or Rich? One of you said that it was like... it was that arcade perfect version of it running in your living room, which was very much not what Time Crisis was. It was like, we've got to do this. Plus the added thing of it being co-op, which was the game changer for us. It was like, so I remember the copy of House of the Dead on my shelf behind me is the one that we went to town to buy it. We both bought a copy with a gun each. We both went back to his and we played through the entire thing in co-op with both of us with light guns. And it was just the best afternoon because we didn't have to put any pounds in the coin slot to play it. But yeah, fantastic game. Looks amazing. Great art style, and as has been alluded to, the voice acting is just diabolical, but is great. You wouldn't want it any other way, much like Resident Evil.
True.
Just gonna say, if you're feeling, you know, like you want to be a badass, you can fire it up in co-op mode and just have yourself with two light guns, which is great.
Huh.
Or you could have two Dreamcasts, two tellies, two light guns, and play the game at the same time, but like maybe with a 10-second delay on one of them. I seem to remember there being a Games Master challenge with that, but with Time Crisis or something, where they literally played two at the same time, but one was like 5 seconds ahead of the other. Maybe we'll have to set that up.
I was going to say, the voice acting, definitely terrible, but I thought it was the worst voice acting I'd ever heard, and then I played Deep Fear, and I think that Deep Fear takes the takes the award for worst voice. Brian's kind of smiling and agreeing, I'm guessing.
I am, but it's so good. It's so good.
It is very good. It's cool. Bad voice acting is great just because you get the added element of comedy, right?
Yeah, and the more non sequiturs that you string together in your dialogue, the better. And I think that's an area where both House of the Dead 2 and Deep Fear very much excel. Although Deep Fear surprisingly had a pretty sound narrative, or at least written wise, but it was very funny how bad the voice acting was in that game.
So bad. So bad. Rich, House of the Dead 2, what are your thoughts?
Oh yeah, absolutely love this game. It's one of my favorite Dreamcast games that was released. One of my two Lightgun games I ever owned, and the other one was like Lethal Enforcers. But I loved House of the Dead because I was a massive zombie fan at the time. I remember sinking quite a few pound coins into the cabinet at Planet Laser near my house. So having it in my own home, just, brilliant. Everything said about the voice acting, I can't agree more. Goldman is one of my favorite video game characters of all time. I love this game. I can't really say anything that's not really been said. It's brilliant. I absolutely love it. It looks fantastic, and it just has such a great pace and energy to it. It is hilarious when it wants to be and when it doesn't intend to be. It's a fantastic package, and it's one of my favorites, and it's one of the games I wish I could relive properly again. I love House of the Dead 2. It's brilliant.
I think I got to play it on a CRT TV recently because I bought one, and it is like you cannot play it without the light gun. It's just not the same, and it's made me really sad that light gun games just aren't really a thing anymore. Modern TVs just can't do them. So
I guess VR is where light gun games go now.
No, honestly, and I think there's a lot to be said for some of the ones that have come out recently. I mean, I really like Rush of Blood, or Until Dawn Rush of Blood, where you're in a roller coaster, and it definitely brings back a lot of the House of the Dead vibes. And it kind of scratches that itch in a way that I wasn't expecting. But both that and House of the Dead 2 are ones I just will routinely play every Halloween. So for what it's worth.
Just a small bit of trivia for you, because we mentioned it earlier. The official light gun from Sega was released in Europe and Asia, but not in the United States due to concerns about bad press.
Yeah.
Soon after the Columbine High School Massacre. When I started that sentence, I didn't know it was going to end with Columbine, so I apologize for that. But yes, that's why it was not released in the US.
It's fine. We've mentioned it twice now, so we've got a good old mention. It's fine.
Yeah, I mean, the cultural impact that it had on how we talked about gun violence here, and just violence in media in general. Like, it was, I wouldn't understate it.
Well, I mean, amazingly, there were two big events in America that shaped Dreamcast games, or the Dreamcast in general. I mean, you had Columbine, and then, of course, I mean, obviously not in 1999, but you had 9/11, which meant that a particular Dreamcast game was never released because of that. It was Propeller Arena, I believe. American events shaping the Dreamcast. There you go. But in terms of House of the Dead 2, are we saying this is a game changer or just a game, Steve?
No. Help me. I really want to say game changer. I can't, though, really. Can I call it a game changer?
And if you want, it's up to you.
I'm gonna call it a game changer.
Oh.
I can't justify that whatsoever. It's a phony response, but
I can justify game changer. Okay. I think it was if nothing else, it was that proper arcade experience at home for light gun games, which I don't think you had up to that point. I can't think of a light gun game that felt like it did in the arcades. You look at Time Crisis, Virtua Cop, all that stuff. None of it looked as good as it did. Mm-hmm. Whereas House of the Dead 2, it looked amazing. My only saying game changer. My only disappointment is that The Lost World never came out on Dreamcast, because that would have been my real game changer, like gun game. But I'll leave that for another episode, maybe.
Rich, what about you?
Yeah, Dogs of the AMS. It is a game changer, definitely. Love it.
Excellent. Brian?
Yeah, I'll say game changer also, and maybe emphatically even, just because I don't think that I really don't think they topped. It remains the peak of that genre for me even today. So I don't know what else to call it other than game changer, because when I think of playing a light gun game, I mean, it's at the top of the list, always top of mind. So got to give it that kind of credit, I suppose.
Okay. Do you know, I was thinking of just calling this a game, but you guys have kind of convinced me otherwise. I think this probably is a game changer. It's, it's stirring up some great memories for me. I'm going to have to go back and play through it properly now. Game changer is then. Another game changer. I mean, this is a Dreamcast podcast, right? I mean, there was very little, like, we were going to have a lot of game changers here. We're all very fond of it. All right, so we've still got four more games to get through, and just for the sake of time, let's treat this as a speed round, and let's only spend a few minutes on each game. So, Brian, your next game, what have you got for us?
All right, I was very close to picking Trick Style for this, because for whatever reason, that is a game I've loved playing more and more as the years go on, but I had to go with Blue Stinger for this pick. I couldn't really fully tell you exactly why. It's a very complicated one, similar to some of the stuff I said about Sonic Adventure. It's a charismatic, janky mess, and that's part of what I love about it. I also feel compelled to evangelize it every chance I get. In fact, I think I talked about it a little bit on the last DreamPod I was on, so definitely going to continue the tradition here. And it also, I don't know, it seems to have I don't know if any of you get this sense, but in the community or the Dreamcast community, I feel like it's kind of taken on a cult status of sorts. I mean, I do think there's more and more people. Every time I post something random about it, like, I get a lot of people who are just like, oh yeah, I love that game. Granted, there's at least half that are just like, I don't get it. You know, what a garbage, you know, janky mess. But hey, it's a divisive one, and I don't know. I feel it's also misunderstood. I think that's kind of the big thing. At the time, especially, it was pigeonholed as this clone of a Resident Evil or Silent Hill sort of survival horror, and I just don't think that's ever what it was. I think, really, it's a bombastic brawler. It's almost like a cinema-influenced B-movie brawler more than anything else. And you know, the big distinction there is that there's a lack of scarcity. So you know, it's definitely not a survival focused game at all. It's more of an action game. And I almost think it has more in common with Dynamite Cop than Resident Evil in a lot of ways, other than an increased emphasis on exploration and light environmental puzzles. And I just love its like weird mix of things that are always at odds with the tone it's trying to set. And so you have this very cinematic presentation, lots of voice acting and characters who are just pretty awful, I would say, the dialogue most of the time is. Quick note, Ryan Drummond and what's his name? Bristow from they both did the voices of Sonic and Eggman respectively in Sonic Adventure, also voiced the two main characters, Elliot and Dogs, in this one. But yeah, and just the idea that you can buy napalm launchers and I don't know, laser swords, lightsabers from vending machines. There's, you know, just an aggressively chipper and vibrant aesthetic to it and soundtrack in some of the spots, but it's also very brooding in others, all against a backdrop of celestial monsters and, you know, I guess big pharma experiments gone awry. I don't know. There's just something to that weird disconnected mix that I just love it for. And it's not a great game. I mean, you could talk about the controls and all of the quirks and everything all day, but kind of like with Sonic Adventure, at the end of the day, especially in my most recent playthrough of it, I just found that those things aren't that big a deal. It's still a very enjoyable game in a lot of ways if you, I don't know, depending on what you're willing to tolerate, I suppose.
True, yeah. I can definitely see kind of the... the action movie aesthetic and almost like a 90s American TV show aesthetic as well. But like, was it Sequest or whatever it was called? And you've got those, the big like opening titles that you might have in a TV show and that kind of stuff. It was, yeah, I can see that. And I can see the Resident Evil comparisons, but only in the Japanese version where it was fixed camera angle.
Yeah.
When it came over to the West, they fixed that. But I mean, fixed it in a very loose term because the camera they replaced it with was terrible.
So. Yeah. Yeah. And when Activision kind of warranted that, obviously, Shinya Nishigaki and his team at Climax Graphics, like they weren't thrilled about having to do that. But honestly, I think that's a example of a marketing choice that may have at least been in the right place because they were looking at presenting it as an action game, which is really what it was, more than a survival horror, which it may have originally been presented more like, for sure.
True. James, have you played much of this one?
I've not played this one. This is one I've watched quite a few people stream it. Never played it myself, but it is on my list of games to play because it is right up my street. So what I've seen, I've enjoyed the look of it. But yeah, not something I've played on myself. So no comment as far as the gameplay is concerned. But it certainly looks very B-movie, which is, as I said, it's very much in my up my street, up my alley, however you want to say it.
Mm-hmm. Have you played Illbleed, James?
I've just started playing that actually on GDMU, which is a great, great experience. But yeah, I can see the comparisons.
Mm. Nice.
Rich, what about you?
Yeah, I was just going to bring up Illbleed, actually. I've played more of that than I have this, but Illbleed's one of those games, probably the one game I've had a real laugh out loud moment at the start. I forget what it was, but I absolutely pissed myself. Blue Stinger, though, I've probably had about 15-20 minutes with this game, but I do appreciate a game that kind of really has those, like, that real B-movie like charm and aesthetic, and it kind of wears it on its sleeve. It kind of knows what it's doing. It's not cheesy in the sense of, like, I almost look at like the likes of House of the Dead 2 and I think it's misguided direction of voice actors, but this game, yeah, it knows what it's doing. It's got a bit of, that's part of its charm. It knows to be cheesy. It knows to really try and evoke that B-movie feel. But yeah, I've not played much of this. It's a game I should go back and spend some time with.
Yeah, fair enough. Steve, is this one you've played?
I think I watched you play this one, did I not?
Quite possibly, yeah.
Yeah, I think, although I think we kind of, the consensus was at the time that it was a little bit shit, so we didn't like play a lot of it, but mm-hmm. I always felt very curious about this game. I liked that it was set at Christmas. That felt very unusual. And I always wanted to sort of hear more of the story and the voice acting and stuff. It seemed like it could have been a good time, but I never really got that deep into it, sadly.
It's like the Die Hard of Dreamcast games, isn't it? It's like, is it a Christmas game or is it just a game set at Christmas?
Yeah. We need to get a poll up on Twitter to see what people think. We need to get a definitive answer to that. We'll get Lewis or Mike on that at some point. All right, let's rate it then. Is this a game changer, Rich? Would you put this as a game changer?
I can only say a game. Kind of like what I say in Dreamcast years. I can't judge it too much. I've not played it. Mm-hmm. It'd be unfair to call it anything less. But yeah, game.
Fair. Brian?
I can't in good conscience call it a game changer. I don't think it really influenced much after it. But I will say that it did carve its own niche and it did its own thing. And it was unapologetically quirky and charming. And in some ways it encapsulates like the way everything about the Dreamcast that I love and how it was misunderstood and how it was just relentlessly and unapologetic and having a vision that, it made choices and it did things. And they weren't necessarily, they were sometimes against the grain of other conventions that were popular at the time, but it's a game. And I love it. It's probably my favorite game of 99 for the Dreamcast, but it's just a game.
Fair enough. James, what are your thoughts?
Just a game. Until I play it and then I maybe just tell you otherwise.
Fair enough. Steve, similar?
Yeah, game. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, I think I agree as well. That's fine. There we go. Another game. And Rich, your next choice, please.
I'm going to go with Hydro Thunder.
Yeah, nice.
Yeah. I absolutely love this game. Very similar to our chat about House of the Dead 2. It's a game that just really captures the feeling of an arcade. Just from the big, loud music and the announcer, big, just fantastic looking graphics, great track design, really nice, tight, varied controls, between all the different boats that you can control. It's just bloody great. It was the first kind of game I think I played where it had some real, like, lose your lunch moments when you went off massive, like, waterfalls and drops. And it almost kind of felt like the nearest gaming had got to those, like the simulators used to go on, like the roller coaster simulators, that kind of thing. Mm. It had that feel to it. Everything about it, from the water physics, which I think are better than Wave Race 64, controversial. just love it. I absolutely love it. It just has so much arcade charm. The way the boats are named, you've got a boat called Damn the Torpedoes, one called Misbehave. The announcer is just hilarious. If you choose one of the harder like tracks, he just starts screaming at you how you're crazy. And then like sirens start going off and fire comes up. It's completely mad. I love it. I absolutely love it. It's one of those games I can't really wax too much lyrical about, because it is very simple in the execution. It's an arcade boat racing game. There's no narrative. It's limited in features because it is a port of an arcade game, but what it does so well. It probably will... I'm torn, but I do want to say, if you factor in all different types of racing games, it is still my favorite racing game on the Dreamcast.
Wow.
Yeah, which I know we live in a world of like F355 Challenge, MSR.
Spirit of Speed.
James, really?
Yeah. But no, Hydro Thunder is fantastic. It pisses me off though, because it does not seem to want to work with my Gecko. Just does not want to force VGA, and I can't play it.
I'm not even sure the All Stars reissue did that. So
I tried that as well.
Yeah.
It's crazy. I don't know.
All right, Steve. Any thoughts about this game?
The waves look real nice. I didn't play it, so that's it from me.
James?
To be honest, I think Richard pretty much nailed all the points. I mean, I am a huge fan of Midway racing games from the late 90s, early 2000s. It's another great arcade racer. It's completely unapologetic, but it does what it says on the tin. Looks great, handles great. What more do you want from a colourful arcade racer from this era? I think I don't think it's a game changer, but I think it's a really, really, really good game.
That's very fair. Brian, what about yourself?
I think it's a classic, honestly. I mean, thinking in context of 98, 99 arcades, there really wasn't anything like it. Even other Midway games didn't quite have the design, I think, nailed to perfection in the way that they had with Hydro Thunder. I think it's endlessly replayable in the way that I can keep coming back to it and discover new shortcuts. Even 20 years later, I still, was finding new ways to tackle that the Nile or the Egypt course, one of the bonus tracks. And I finally beat it after like 20 years, just a few months ago. Mm-hmm. And so that was really, really exciting for me. But just the idea that I could continue to explore and discover things after all that time was something I think it says a lot about the longevity of Hydro Thunder as an experience over the years.
All right, what are we saying in terms of where it sits then? Rich, is this a game changer?
For me, it was a game changer. I adore it, and there's only, what, maybe 2-3 years ago, I was in the States, and I was in snowy Idaho, and I found a Bojangles arcade, and I actually found a Hydro Thunder cabinet, and wow. it was like 50 cents to play, and I've always wanted to play in the arcades, having played the Dreamcast game for years, and it was absolutely fantastic. So yeah, it's a game changer for me. I love it. And also you can unlock the Titanic in it as well if you want to be really, really tasteless, which is fantastic. So game changer. Wow.
Okay. Brian?
Yeah, I mean, up until COVID, I haven't been to an arcade since that. But I live in Seattle, and there's at least a few places around here that still have Hydro Thunder. So I continue to play it whenever I get a chance there. But yeah, it's a game changer. I am always hankering for a good water-based racing game. And just throughout history, there haven't been enough amazing ones. And maybe that's just because Wave Race completely obliterated or I don't know, corrupted my expectations for or set that bar really high, because that's one of my all-time favorite racing games. But Hydro Thunder, you know, scratched that itch really well, as well as having, you know, the pinnacle of design sensibilities that Midway was known for. I gotta say, it's definitely a game changer.
Cool. James?
As good as it was, it's just going to be a game for me. There was so many arcade races in this era, and personally, it didn't do anything for me above and beyond. I could have spent an hour playing Cruising World, and I would have had just as much enjoyment as I would have had playing any of the Thunder games. So that's not to take anything away from the game. It's a really, really good game, but it's just it didn't move the bar on for me.
We can also talk about how easily you can lump all the Thunder games together. I feel like the tier is very different between a four-wheel and Arctic compared to Hydro, but that's a different discussion for a different day, probably.
Cool. Steve?
Yeah, I mean, I can only really say game for this one, sure. having not played it, but I very much enjoyed the impassioned pitches there.
Indeed. That means it's two each. That means my vote counts to where this goes. No, I think I can only really say it's a game. Unfortunately, I haven't played enough of it to say anything more. So it is going to be a game. There you go.
I'm glad that landed on you and not me.
Yeah, very true. All right, next up, we've got James, and your next game is...
My next game is Ready to Rumble Boxing, which I picked because, for me, it's another one of those kind of iconic games that I immediately associate with Dreamcast, even though it was released on practically every console of the time. It's one of the, again, because it was kind of on the first demo disc, it was one of those ones I remember always playing in Toys R Us or in Odeon cinemas. It was just always the game that was on. And I kind of got really exhausted by beat 'em up games at this point. Like in the Super Nintendo era, I was super into Ultimate Mortal Kombat 3. And then when like Tekken and Virtua Fighter and everything came out following that, and even Soul Calibur, as good as it was, there was just something I didn't really, I was just burnt out by spending so long playing sort of Mortal Kombat up to that point. So I was kind of done with fighting games. I kind of liked Victory Boxing on the PlayStation, but it was just a bit too realistic for me. So seeing this thing was just such a breath of fresh air to the fighting genre. Didn't take itself too seriously. It also wasn't just an aimless button masher. Like there's enough strategy in this game to mean that you don't just pick up a controller and bash a load of buttons. But also you don't have to spend like an entire week dedicating yourself to one character to learn all their moves and their unblockables and everything else. So it was just a perfect fighting game for me. I absolutely adored playing it. It was just, I think all the extra additions they added on with the training modes and stuff was really cool. But it was just fun to play, and that's kind of the key thing with this game. It was it had enough depth, but it was something you could pick up and play, and you could feel yourself getting better as you started to learn the kind of the patterns of the other boxers. I mean, there's certainly elements of Punch-Out in it from that regard. But, you know, great variety of cast, really original. Obviously, original cast because it was the first in the series, and it was just a real good feel good game. You know, it was an arcade game that wasn't actually an arcade game, so it did have a bit of depth to it. And I think it looked fantastic. And as I said, it was just one of those games that you immediately, or I immediately, associate with Dreamcast, even though it was Dreamcast, PlayStation, N64. And I think there was a Game Boy version or something crazy like that of it as well. So yeah, really good one for my two cents.
Cool. Rich, is this one that you've played?
Yeah, absolutely. I love Ready to Rumble. I mean, the thing that does still stand out to me with this game is this was the one I associate with the Dreamcast being playable in shops. It felt like regardless of how well or how not so well the Dreamcast did in terms of, you know, sales, this felt like the game that was going to kind of bring people over. And like what James said, it was on other formats, but I too really associated it with the Dreamcast. And I felt like this was the game that could have sold some people that were still on the fence because it looked so great. And in terms of, you know, being playable in shops, it brought people together and they were playing one-on-one. So you had that real, like, you know, couch co-op feel to it. Oh, not couch co-op, sorry, but, you know, couch competitive gaming. Yeah, I love it. Characters fantastic. I was kind of quite into boxing games around this time as well, more so the likes of Knockout Kings and Fight Night. But yeah, I love me some arcade, so Ready to Rumble was a refreshing take on the boxing genre and a game I do still really enjoy playing today. Yeah, no, I love Ready to Rumble.
Awesome. Brian, what yourself?
This one's hard for me. It's definitely a game I enjoyed a lot back when it came out. I feel like revisiting it today, even getting over the very creepy Michael Buffer, virtual Michael Buffer, that just every time it's just like, ugh, that, and then just the weird, like, stereotypical, you know, culture stereotypes it throws in there for all the boxers. You know, there's a lot of it that hasn't aged well. Unfortunately, the thing I think really hasn't aged well is the gameplay. I do not feel it has, and for whatever depth it may have, I was disappointed to find out how easily it could be circumvented just through spamming uppercuts to get Rumble. And then, you know, I basically just cheesed my way through the entire campaign from scratch when I played it a few months ago, just doing that. And I didn't feel like it forced me to have to learn really anything about the mechanics or the physics or the boxer's tendencies. So it's still fun. It's still charismatic. It's still, you know, somewhat enjoyable, but I would not necessarily call it deep, or at least deep in a way that forced me to have to reckon with its systems. So yeah, that's kind of where I'm at. I don't think it's aged very well for me.
Okay. Steve, have you played this one?
Yeah, briefly. I also associate this one with the Dreamcast, but I think every time I've played this, it can be boiled down to in a shop, a kiosk. I don't think I ever actually like sat down for any great length of time to play this. But when I did play it, I remember it feeling very stiff and close quarters, and it wasn't for me. But that said, it's very iconic, and I think of Dreamcast, this is one of the games I think of. I remember the guy with the afro, and of course Mr. Buffer saying that thing, what he says. But it just isn't for me, this one.
Fair enough. I've never played it, so I can't have much of an opinion on it. So I'm going to go right in there and just say game. Rich?
It's still a strong game for me. It didn't change the world, but okay. it's a strong one.
James?
Yeah, it's definitely not a game changer, but it's a very good game.
Fair. Brian?
I'd also say it's a game. I mean, you know, for its faults, I just still, you know, it's not shit. Still rather amusing, but I just can't really play it for longer than 10 minutes before I have to pop in Soul Calibur or something else.
Steve?
Yeah, game.
Fair enough. Game it is. And speaking of Soul Calibur, Steve, your last game.
Yes, my last game is, in fact, Soul Calibur. I'm not a fighting game person. I really wish I was. But I've attempted to be a fighting game person. I even bought like paraphernalia to try and become a fighting game person, but it's just not in me. I just get my ass handed to me. And that's not that fun. But Soul Calibur is of course it's a fighting game, but I consider it very differently to any other fighting game. And I think that's primarily because of the movement, the way this game moves. You got the eight way movement. It was just kind of a revelation. And this is, I've had the most fun with this game out of any fighting game I've ever played, and other entries in the series as well, although albeit to a lesser degree as they went on. Hours and 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 hours sunk into this thing. It felt like it would never get old, and I could still play it now and it would feel exactly as fun as it did at the time. It's playing this at the time as well, it was jaw-dropping how good this game looked. It looked like arcade game. It was the best looking game I'd ever seen. The animations were incredibly fluid. You had what felt like, you know, millions of moves at your disposal, depending on what you pressed, in what direction you pressed it in, and where you were stood at the time. But those animations blended together really fluidly, and the fights in this game just look so good. They just look so fluid and good, and it feels as good to do that as it does to watch it happening. Yeah, it's a brilliant game. And the thing that I want to like about fighting games is I want to like the idea of like tricking my opponent and like juking their moves and getting one over on them by being smarter. And I can't do that in fighting games normally, but I can do that in this one. I feel like it's a purer fighting game in that respect, because if you're clever, you don't need to be able to dial in the combos to succeed. And some people complain that it's button mashy, but that's, you could certainly win by mashing the buttons, but I think as a criticism that doesn't really stand up. If you're losing to a button masher, you need to get good, is what I would say to those people. But yeah, just phenomenal game.
Cool. Rich, what about you? What are your thoughts on this?
Yeah, really everything Steve said. I mean, this was, for the longest time, the only fighting game I've ever owned. Never really cared much for the genre whatsoever. Something just compelled me to have this on the Dreamcast. I mean, obviously, I think at the time it was a real big standout game from a technical standpoint. It looked incredible. And I decided I wanted it. And I also sunk many hours into it. Looks fantastic, plays fantastic, and something about it is so finely tuned that for the likes of me, and also like what Steve said, even if you're not necessarily like good or great at fighting games, it makes you feel like you're fantastic. Like, it's so accessible, the way the moves chain together. I've never felt so skilled at playing a fighting game, but not knowing how or why. It's certainly no, it's not through any more effort of my part. It's just tuned just right. And yeah, that to me is a satisfying game experience. I want to feel like I'm just kicking ass, whether it's against the CPU or another person next to me. The use of weapons in it, love it. I think there was like the story mode in it. Was it like a tournament mode? I forget. But I sunk so many hours into that. And I don't think I actually ever played against a human player the whole time I owned this game, but wow. I loved it the whole time. And it still holds up today. It looks fantastic on HD TV. Absolutely.
Very true.
Amazing. Very true. Game.
James, what about yourself?
Short and sweet. It's probably the only Dreamcast game that received perfect scores in magazines that actually deserves it. And you know, has lasted the test of time. It is a phenomenal fighter. I think it was many, 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 many years later that it was, before it was topped as a before better fighting games were actually released. And I think it was a launch title in the West, you know, as well. It was just, it was just add the icing on the cake. It is, it is an outstanding game and completely deserved the full marks that it received from many publications on launch.
Mm-hmm. Brian, what about yourself?
Yeah, I mean, I don't really believe in that there's such thing as an objectively anything as far as video game quality, but if there is an objectively best game on Dreamcast or maybe even the generation, I would say Soul Calibur is certainly in the running for that moniker. It's just a solid, polished, all-around title I think Rich and Steve, you hit the nail on the head as far as using the word accessibility or at least intuitive. I would say it's intuitive for anybody who's not really, you know, in the genre or into the genre. And it's not as demanding as like even a Virtua Fighter or other games of that, let alone like a Street Fighter or any of the SNK 2D fighting games. So, yeah, I mean, I don't really have anything negative to say about it. I loved it at the time. I still love it now. I don't think it's, you know, for me, it like maybe doesn't the charm of a thing of something like Blue Stinger maybe, you know, makes that one of my favorite games. But this is certainly in terms of 1999 classics from the Dreamcast era, like objectively, and I use that with air quotes, you can't really top it. It's such a good game.
Yeah. I agree with everything that everybody said, and I'm going to jump right in there and say it was a game changer. Steve?
Yeah, I mean, I could go on. Like, I could go on and on about this game, but we're trying to do this, you know, a bit faster than the first round of games. So I'll just keep it to, yes, it is a game changer.
Indeed. Rich?
Yep, game changer. Nothing more to say about that, really.
Same for me, game changer.
Brian?
Yeah, ditto.
Awesome. Cool. My game is going to be Power Stone, and I'm literally just going to ask people, because we all know what Power Stone is. We all know that game fairly well. Rich, do you think that one's a game changer? Ooh. Silence.
I'm going to say strong game. I honestly don't actually love the Power Stone games as much as other people do. Never got on with them all that well. I won't lie. I've tried. Just, it's not for lack of trying.
Find the hang-up button for Rich. James?
I will say game changer. Brought something new to the genre again. Moved things forward. And it was, when I've said before many times, the first game I ever played on Dreamcast, and it was a big eye-opener for me. So I'll say game changer for that one.
Cool. Brian, what about yourself?
This is also a hard one. I feel like I probably agree with Rich on this. It's certainly an enjoyable game, but not really one that I can go back to and enjoy more than, you know, once every few years. It's great multiplayer. I mean, I think Power Stone 2 ultimately did everything better, and so maybe that's also overshadowing it a little bit. But I really enjoyed Power Stone, but I just can't think of it as anything more than a game.
Okay, all right, Steve, this is on you. Game or game changer?
Where Brian and Rich agree elsewhere illustrates clearly that Power Stone didn't have enough forklift driving in it. I would love to say game changer. I really would, because I love this game, and in my heart it is a game changer. But you know, and these days these kinds of games are hot shit. Mm-hmm. But to suggest that there is any link between Power Stone and the current trend of couch co-op and couch competitive games is a stretch. Power Stone didn't set the world on fire. It should have, but it didn't. And so I don't feel like I can call it a game changer. I think I can only say strong game.
Okay, that's three people I need to hang up on. anyway, moving on. We're nearly at the end now. Sorry, it's been a bit of a bumper size episode, but we do like to end our Dreamcast Year episodes with a quiz. So I am bringing that to this crossover. And I've got a little bit of something different. So usually we will do kind of a game where I ask whether the game title that I say was released in the year that we're talking about or 10 years later. So whether it was kind of released 1999 or 2009, lots of obscure game titles come up and you just have to guess which year it came out in. However, However, I'm not going to do that this time. I'm going to change it up a little bit for DreamPod. So first of all, you're going to be working in teams. So it's James and Brian as Dreamcast Junkyard team versus Rich and Steve for the Dreamcast Years team. You can confer, but you'll only have 20 seconds to guess the answer to each question. And this time I'm going to be doing anagrams of Dreamcast game titles. So you need to crack the anagram within 20 seconds. You can confer in your team. You get three each. And if we do tie, there is a tiebreaker question where basically the first person to answer gets the point. Does that all make sense?
Yeah.
Yep, it does.
Good. I'm getting my stopwatch ready and getting the quiz ready. First up is going to be the Dreamcast Junkyard team. So James and Brian, get ready. You've got 20 seconds to answer this. You can confer. And your first anagram is sleeved dips. Sleeved dips.
Sleeved dips. Mm-hmm. Okay. So two D's there?
Yep.
Okay. How much time do we have? If
you're putting this into an anagram machine, you only have a few seconds left.
Pass. I have no idea.
Yeah.
Brian?
I feel like there's not going to be many people scoring high on this.
Your time's up. Definitely. Then no guess.
Are these 99 games or are these?
Yeah, they're all 99 games.
Oh, shoot. Okay. Well, I'm drawing a blank.
Rachel, Steve, would you have any idea what this is?
Not a clue.
No.
No.
All right. The game was Speed Devils.
Of course.
Speed Dips.
It seems so obvious now.
Yeah. Is it obvious now? But yeah. All right. Next one. I gave you guys 30 seconds rather than 20. So I'm going to do that going forward because 20 didn't seem like quite enough. Steve and Rich, your game is ear sowing. Sowing is in sowing seeds. Ear sowing. Ear sowing.
Is it Aero Wings?
It is.
Oh, nice.
Well done.
Nailed
very
it.
Very good. Aero Wings it is. That's 1 point for Dreamcast Years. All right. Next game, Dreamcast Junkyard team. Your anagram is eight flowers. That is flowers as in what you make bread from. Eight flowers.
Eight flowers.
Power Stone.
Any ideas?
No, not Power Stone.
Air Force Delta? No. Shoot.
Is it 8 as in E-I-G-H-T-8, as in the number 8, or 8 as in you ate some food?
It is 8 as in the number 8. 8 flowers. Flowers in what you make bread from. Any ideas?
I'm really bad at this.
Yeah, I'm bad too.
No. I mean, your time is up, but no guesses?
It's fine. Nope.
No. Rich, Steve, any?
I don't know.
the game that you're looking for is Soul Fighter.
Soul Fighter. Yeah, that's best that we, you know, block that out of memory anyway.
That's fair. All right, Dreamcast Years team, your next game is Madam Wrongdoers. Madam Wrongdoers. See a lot of serious thought going on.
Doers Madam Wrong? Was that a game?
No, surprisingly. No idea?
I have not a clue, no.
Your time is up. Rich, any
Come
guess?
On, Rich.
Nope, can't.
No. Be. Brian, James, can you guess this one at all?
I'm going to guess Worms Armageddon?
Yeah.
Of course.
Well done.
Another game. Damn.
Good
job.
We'll have a point
for that.
Remember the two Ds? I was like, there's D. Yeah, okay. That tracks.
All right. Dreamcast Junkyard team, your next game is Dream Grief. Dream Grief.
Dream Grief? Oh, my Lord. I have to write that out.
Dream Grief.
I want to say nope. Keep wanting to say Grandia, but that's definitely not.
Man, this is so much harder than you'd think.
Yeah.
Is your time is up. Any guesses?
No.
Not really.
No. Rich, Steve, I guess, any guess at all?
Nope.
No.
No.
No. Okay, it's Frame Grid or Frame Grid or however you pronounce
oh,
it.
Oh, okay, so Japanese-only games are included here. Got it.
As long as they release in 1999, they're in there.
Now I got all right. My sphere of thinking here. All right.
Okay. Sounds... All right, last one for Dreamcast years, and your game... Well, your anagram is Sooner Wept. Sooner Wept.
Power Stone.
Yeah.
Boom. Boom. Look at this teamwork. It's incredible.
They definitely got the easy ones, Brian.
Yeah, I feel.
I think Madam Wrongdoers was difficult. I don't know. Well, there we go. The Dreamcast Years team did win, but I'm going to give you the tiebreaker just see if you can get it. And the tiebreaker would have been Healthy Hawking Ecology.
Healthy Hawking Ecology. Mm-hmm. Seventh Cross Evolution?
No. Nope. Healthy Hawking Ecology. I think James might know this one.
I certainly don't.
No.
Monaco Grand Prix?
No.
There's no X in there.
Healthy Hawking. Oh, TNN Motorsport. What do they call Buggy Heat in?
We called it Buggy Heat here as well.
Yeah, we called it Motor. Yeah, never mind.
No. I'll put you out of your misery. It's Tokyo Highway Challenge.
Oh, yeah.
Good game. There we go.
Well, we suck at anagrams. There you go. We learned that
today. There you go.
And we did.
My brain and Rich, does not work that way.
Me and Rich are awesome at them.
Yeah, you got a really easy one.
I don't know. I thought Sleeved Dips was going to be an easy one, but there you go. There you go.
I thought Sleeved Dips was going to be something else before you finished saying it.
All right, well, we're going to do one of these for each of the years that we do when we go through these episodes. So let's just see if Dreamcast Junkyard win or if Dreamcast Years win. We will find out. Anywho, that is the end of this episode. Thank you, everybody, for joining me. It's been wonderful to speak to you all. Let me just go around. So obviously, Dreamcast Junkyard, you can find at thedreamcastjunkyard.co.uk. And you can also find us on Twitter, which is at the DC Junkyard. We're also on Discord. So pop over to the website where you can find a link to that. James, where can we find you personally on Twitter?
You can find me at Agile Harvey on Twitter.
Excellent. Brian, what about you?
I'm at Virtua Schlub. So like Virtua Fighter, but Schlub. It's awesome. Kind of weird, but whatever.
It's a good name. In terms of Dreamcast Years, you can find us at dreamcastyears.co.uk. All our podcasts are there. And a bit of information about the Dreamcast Year 1 and Dreamcast Year 2 books. And you can also find us on Twitter at Dreamcast Years. And Rich, where can we find you on Twitter?
Okay, let me get this right. Okay, you can find me on Twitter at The Bitten Hero.
That's BITTEN, is that right?
Mm-hmm.
The Bitten Hero. Okay, interesting. New one. So if you've listened to any of Dreamcast Years, it's no longer at Dreamcast Barber, it's at The Bitten Hero. So get used to that.
Diversify my content, you know, reach more people.
Steve, where can we find you?
You can find me at Steve Jack.
Excellent. You can find me at Oddment84. And thank you so, so much for joining us for this episode. Hope you enjoyed it. And we'll see you next time. Until then, see you later.
Bye.
Bye.
See ya.